Welcome to Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness, a weekly podcast where passionate advocates of mental health converge to illuminate unseen struggles faced by millions. Join Jeremy, Terrell, and Lorraine as they delve into candid conversations about stigmas, cultural risk, values, intersectionality, and mental health. Hear from mental health professionals and those diagnosed with a mental illness. Together, they put on the table the things people think about but are afraid to talk about. Get ready to embark on an insightful journey.
Welcome to our next podcast, Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness. We have Tony Goins here, Terrell Newby. I'm really excited to have you here with us. We're actually at your establishment, which
it's good to be here.
You bet.
Capital Cigar Lounge, Lincoln, Nebraska.
Capital Cigar. Right. I guess we can.
Can we light up?
Absolutely. Let's light
cigars.
Up.
Yeah, right,
Tony. Nothing better than cigars and coffee in the morning. Yes, indeed.
Don't let it touch the flame, right?
Right. So what's the unique thing about smoking a cigar? I often say
I never smoke a cigar. I enjoy a cigar.
You have a cutter.
Cigarette smokers smoke.
Okay. Okay.
Those of us that are partake in the culture of the leaf, we enjoy.
Enjoy a cigar.
Just a tad different in terms of the wording. Yes, sir. I know I've got a cutter.
Okay.
Oh. Cutter.
Cutter. Did I give it to you? Back. There we go.
Yeah, there's a cutter.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about us and what we do and how we're hoping that what you have to share aligns with what we're trying to get out there.
Sure, sure.
So with Hidden Battles, essentially what we try to put together for people is like, a lot of times I think when people are watching our podcast, they think it's about mental illness, but we get into so many other areas. And so to kind of give you a foundation, there was a woman, and I keep forgetting her name, Lorraine, what was her name,
Kimberly Crenshaw,
a black woman, and she was a social worker. Mm-hmm. And so she coined the term intersectionality. And essentially what it means, in short, is that you're born into something. So you're born into a race, into a gender or gender expression. You're born into a sexual orientation. You're born into a financial status. You're born into ability or disability. And so depending on what you're born into and how those variables come together,
sure,
sets you up for resources or barriers.
Mm.
So obviously we can take any combination of those and we could say, we can predict, you know, if you are a rich white billionaire and you have children, but they are disabled, they're going to have higher resources than somebody who was a poor white person that was disabled. So,
sure.
But any combination of those things. And so with that kind of in our background, you know, I think I want to start off, and if you need a few moments to think about it while we get our cigars going, I guess, what would have been a pivotal moment in your life? And I know it's hard to probably come up with one because, you know,
sure,
you've been through a lot. You have a lot of successes in your history. Is there one that kind of just sticks out that we can maybe capture the audience with?
Yeah, so a few things. So first of all, I want to thank you all for allowing me the opportunity to participate in this production.
Absolutely.
You guys are consummate professionals, and it's just really an honor to be able to participate. So that's number one. I think number two, it's always important for me to say this, that anything that I say is not predicated on self-glorification.
Yeah.
That's really important for me. It's typically a little challenging for me to talk about myself, but it's not about self-glorification. If I share something, it's always with the hope and the prayer that anything that I share can help someone else. I think number three, I get up every day and thank God for his grace and for his mercy, and I'm still in this fight. And so for me, success is a word that I think breeds complacency.
Mm.
I always say, God, don't give me success. Give me wisdom and give me a greater level of influence. And let that influence be for your kingdom. Like,
absolutely,
that's really important to me. I also want to say, listen, we're sitting here in the Capitol Cigar Lounge. I'm enjoying a cigar. It's called Definition Cigars. My good friend Jamon Hackley out of Dallas, Texas. He's also a man of faith, and he and I have connected over the years. And so, you know, that's it. So I would say, listen, pivotal moment in my life was, been a number of them, but one of them was becoming a teenage parent. I became a dad at 17 years of age. And all of a sudden, I had to be a man. You know, I come from a single-parent home. My mother, Laverne Goins, was a powerful figure in my life, and my grandmother, Mabel Davis. A number of powerful figures in my life, but my mom was, she was an English teacher, and I often say I would rather for an English, my teacher at school to grade my paper than for my mother to grade my paper. Because when she got that red pen out, Laverne did not play. But I became a teenage father, and I grew up in what is called the Church of God in Christ, Kojic, and it was devastating for me because I felt like that I let folks down around me. But it caused me to kind of change trajectories in terms of what my life was going to be and what I was going to do. You know, I was junior class president, senior class president. I had a fair amount of accolades in high school, and I was, you know, supposed to go right off to college and have this traditional type of life where you do well in high school, you go to college, you graduate from college, and you start your life, you start your career. That was the path that my mother had me on. But now I'm becoming a dad. And, you know, in the black community, especially back then, you take care of your responsibility. And my parents, my mother, she didn't have a lot of money, so I had to make some financial decisions right away at 17 about how I was going to take care of this kid. And so that financial decision was to join the Marine Corps. Because by joining the Marine Corps, my child would have medical benefits. And I remember my senior year in high school when I would have to take her to the doctor. I bagged groceries at a grocery store, so I had to have cash money because I didn't have any insurance. It's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about insurance right now, because I know what it's like not to have insurance. It is a scary, scary, scary feeling to know that you don't have coverage, and if something happens to you, you know, it could be a problem.
It'll ruin everything. I mean, yeah, take you down everything. Financially, your house. I mean, that story's all over America.
America. So that was a pivotal moment. You know, instead of going to college, I had to join the Marine Corps. I got married at 18. I had a kid at 17. I got married at 18. So now all of a sudden, I'm an 18-year-old. Not even 20, 21, not even legal from that perspective, but I'm a grown man.
Yeah.
That was a pivotal moment.
Yeah.
Without question.
So if you could capture that era or that time frame in your life, what word would you put to it? If you could just put one word to that time, any word, strength, dignity, passion,
scared.
Okay. Yeah.
Scared.
And so you're scared at that point in your life. What pushed you past the fear? Because I think it's one of the, and I'm speaking from a male's perspective here.
Sure.
One of the things that we have to learn to do as men is push past fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be there. You don't get used to the world in such a way that fear just disappears. Nobody, right. So how did you, because that's what defines courage is, you embrace that fear and you do things while you're scared.
Yep.
It's not like I have so much courage that I'm going to all of a sudden fear goes out the world. No, you push yourself through it. So
sure.
I already know God's got to be somewhere in there.
Oh, 100%.
100%. What else would you?
Fear of failure. Mm-hmm. Like I come from a family. When I look at my mother as the central figure in my life, I saw her grow through various challenges, but she never stopped. So a motivating factor for me became the fear of failure. So when you fear failure, you push beyond your limits. And failure becomes not an option. Like, what are you talking about? You're going to fail. You got this kid. What are you talking about? This kid's not going to have you. No.
Now, how much of the
failure?
You were in the Marine Corps, and, mm-hmm. and a lot of folks in military service say that the Marines are the very best. They are the most disciplined. they are the toughest of all the four branches of the military. How much did that environment help shape you and mold you with what you brought to it prior to being in the service?
Yeah, Terrell, I think that's a great question. What I will tell you is that growing up in my mother's home, there was always a level of intensity already. You know, we didn't grow up in a home where everybody was saying, I love you and all this kind of stuff. You know, we knew our mother loved us, me and my two sisters, Robin and Phyllis. But there was not this all of this, you know, love, and it just wasn't my home.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, right or wrong, it wasn't my home. But when I joined the Marine Corps, let me put it like this. The level of intensity, I mean, listen, the Marine Corps and what you're trained to do is you're trained to kill. That's what you're trained to do.
Yeah.
Every Marine is a rifleman.
At the end of the day, that's what they're doing.
At the end of the day, so think about it like this. Take an 18-year-old. You are not fully developed yet mentally in terms of your value systems.
Exactly.
And what you... And a true understanding of right and wrong. You're just not. You're still developing. So you take a kid at that age and you pump this adrenaline to the extent that your job, and I was a machine gunner in the Marine Corps. And I was a part of the 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. I was attached to the S1 shop as a legal chief. But at the end of the day, my primary MOS was an 0331, which is a machine gunner. So now you got this 18, 19-year-old kid, and you're trained. You know, it's not just, you know, this guy's going to give his, I'm going to give my life for my country. That guy over there going to give his life for his country, and I'm going to be the one that's going to make him do it.
Yeah.
So understand that mentality. Let that resonate for a minute.
Well, I want to repeat that. Basically, what you just said was that it's either you or him.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what the purpose of the war was or what the geopolitical strategies are at the time. You're there right in the front lines against another person.
Sure.
Who was probably 18 or somewhere around there.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so both of y'all are in a position where you
just
haven't
so
fully
you know,
developed
I don't agree
yet.
With that right now.
Yeah. I mean.
You know, I mean, can I be myself?
Absolutely.
Okay. It's I got a whole different view about that because, listen, wars, you know, I've not been alive when a true war was fought on American soil. But imagine going to somebody else's country, somebody else's front door. Somebody you don't know. Somebody that has not done anything to your family. Like, if you do something to my family, I'm provoked to go do something to you.
Exactly. Or even our country. You know, if somebody comes over to our country, you know, then there's at least there's something
in there. We're going
to
your country. We're going to kick your door in. And we're going to do some bad things to you.
Right. Well, obviously, there's a reason. And generally, it's based upon economics.
I do want to be clear. You know, I'm proud of my service to this country. And what I will tell you is that the primary, and this is really important, as Americans, our freedom is not free. And we could not sit here right now in this establishment if we did not have the American military. Because what I do know is that there are bad guys that are out there that if our military wasn't who we are
exactly.
what we are,
they'd take advantage of us.
They would come over.
Absolutely,
yeah.
they would.
Yeah.
So what I did understand was that I was defending the country. It was a preventative action.
Right.
It was preventative. Because they would come over here and they would do something to us. The bad guys out there like that.
Absolutely. And so I think, like, for me, when I hear that period of your life, you know, there's pivotal moments in everybody's life, whether you're male or female, where you have to decide about your history and what you could, because what I just heard you do was you admitted or you acknowledged that there was a part of you that disagrees with an 18-year-old person going to war, but at the same time, you were able to look beyond your experience and talk about how, you know, where our country would be without the American military. And I think that people can have that dialectic or that dynamic conversation. You can, it's not, you know, we tend to live in a country where it's right or left or up or down or, you know, and so how do we have these dynamic conversations where we can, because that's where improvement comes in.
It is.
Where are we good?
It is.
How do we build on our good? But where do we make mistakes and how can we improve those mistakes?
And you know, it comes from, I mean, when you losing a life, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a hard pill to swallow when you're that young and a life is taken,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it just makes it very difficult, you know? So anyway, that was a pivotal moment in my life, you know?
Yeah, no doubt.
Everything changed from the time I became a teenage parent and joined the Marine Corps, which, you know, I'm extremely proud of. It did instill a higher level of intensity and an extreme amount of discipline in terms of my life, period, in general.
And so there's a lot of couple things. I'm going to let Jeremy deal with the PTSD part. But
sure.
So being in the Marine Corps and being in a system that is designed to be very regimented, and mm-hmm. it is black and white in the military.
Yes, okay? It is.
And so once you become a civilian.
How would you know all this, Terrell?
Because I'm a veteran.
He's a veteran.
Okay. I'm a special ops.
Just for the audience, to remind people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're taught to kill people, strategize how to get the enemy and how to protect
That's right.
ourselves.
That's right.
On behalf of the U.S. Constitution.
Okay? Without question.
Without question.
Without question.
So you let's make it clear, we volunteered.
We volunteered.
No one said you have to do it.
Yep.
So
I was not drafted.
We're all bought in on the system.
You better believe.
And we become a part of that system because we know that if we don't, mm-hmm. we don't want to go back home and be a failure to the family. Well, I thought what happened, you got, you know.
That's
so
right.
Or you went to Leavenworth because you didn't do what you're supposed to do.
That's right.
So we were both honorably discharged.
We were.
As it pertains to you, though, in your life, how did that impact you once you got out? And the way that you related to people,
you know, Terrell, that's a great question. Let me say this.
Can I really quick? How did you reacclimate?
Yeah.
There you go. Man.
Yeah. There you go.
Jeremy was terrible. It did not. It did. It wasn't well. It was not well. You know, I will say this. You know, I'm very proud of my oldest daughter because she was born when I was 17, and now she's in her early 40s. She's a wife. She has four beautiful children. And this Wednesday, she tacks on to her name, Dr. Goins Brockman.
Oh,
so statistically, when you think about the children of teenage parents, there's a high failure rate for both the parent and for the kid.
Right.
Through the grace of God, Tony and I, we broke that statistic.
Yeah.
You know, she's Dr. Goins Brockman as of this Friday when she walks across that stage. She's got three degrees.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of her, man. I'm very, very, very
That's
proud
awesome.
Of my daughter. I call her Tony, T-O-N-I, but I named her Tanika. She knows she's still my Tony, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, listen, can I be myself?
Of course.
I was terrible. I was terrible. And back then, they didn't talk about the term PTSD wasn't even.
It was like shell shock, or I don't remember what they were using.
I don't know what it was.
That had to have been in the 90s.
But you know, yeah. No, I got out in 86.
86,
but, you know,
okay.
Yeah, I went in 81, got in 86. But when I got out, you know, I went, I checked out, I got my bags, and I drove home. I didn't have no conversations. You can't take someone from that type of environment and then let them out and think everything's going to be okay, because it's not okay. And I was not okay.
Well, I think that speaks to the tradition of the VA is, okay, we got what we needed out of you. You served your time. Now you're none of our business anymore. But I think every president for a long time.
I didn't even go to the VA. I didn't know I was supposed to go.
I didn't know any of that.
And unfortunately,
but then the culture around mental health at the time was still heavy stigma, which is what we're talking about, is destigmatizing mental illness.
Sure, sure.
And illness doesn't, you know, illness is a little bit of a tricky word, but
I didn't think I didn't call myself mentally ill. I was just crazy.
And that's just the way that
everybody around me was walking on eggshells. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not right. My family was walking. Everybody around me was walking on eggshells. They did not deserve that. But they was all walking on eggshells because I was amped up like you would not believe. I was amped up like you would not believe about everything.
Yeah.
Some examples.
Man, if I walk in the house and something's out of order, that's a problem. Like, that's a major problem.
Yeah.
If everybody's not in line, I mean, that's the way the Marine Corps is.
Right,
everybody's not in line. Everybody's not moving fast enough. You're not moving fast enough. this not done. Like, I wouldn't even let my son talk to me sitting on the bed. He laughs about it now.
Yeah.
Put your bootstraps up and put your feet on the ground. Like, yeah. He could never talk to me sitting on the bed. Mm. He'd be on his feet when he was talking to me. You know? I was amped up.
Yeah.
Amped up, man. They didn't deserve that. I'm very remorseful for that. I'm extremely remorseful for that to this day. But at the time, I didn't know what was happening or why it was happening.
Just to be clear, like, man to man, I don't hear you providing excuses for your behavior. I hear providing an explanation.
Yeah, no excuse.
And it's not like you're trying to dismiss what happened. You're taking accountability for it. But here's a question is, you have somebody who, you know, had a child at 17, went into the military, left. You were affected by those experiences. Then you get out. Then you. I hear you recognizing that you made mistakes.
Sure, I did.
And so, what do you do with that every day? How do you manage that? Because it lives in you. Clearly,
yeah,
it does.
Yeah.
How? What do you do with that?
Was that like a process?
Yes.
Evolving over time.
It absolutely, 100%, 100%. You know what I knew I had to do was I had to provide. You know, there are two triggers for me that kind of take me to another space. One is my finances have to be in order. Because when you've been really, really, really broke and you've had bad things happen, that's why I always preach financial literacy and economic education. Because when you are in a state of financial distress, the decisions that you make are not good decisions. Typically, decisions you make are not good decisions. And so to answer your question, listen, I would get up every day and go to work. I worked 3 or 4 jobs, you know. I was a security guard at American Express, and I unloaded trucks at night. I made $6 and a penny as a security guard. I think I made $8 unloading trucks. And I had a wife and 2 kids that I needed to take care of. So my mode of thinking wasn't about, you know, love and all this softness. It was about making sure that I was going to be able to pay the bills, they had a roof over their head, and that I could provide food. That was my mindset every day. Nothing else mattered.
I know this might seem like a quick switch up, but it's a little bit of a I want to ask you this question directly. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about homeless people?
You know, listen, I've got a lot of empathy for homeless people. I do. Because it's clear that something happened in their lives for them to be in that state.
Yeah.
And if the homelessness is attached to mental illness, then listen, you got to have people like organizations to help with that. But what I tend to say is, listen, I think financial literacy and economics should be the basis for everything that happens in everybody's life from the time the kid is born. Because if it's homelessness because the person made bad decisions about their finances, then what I think is, then somehow you got to get them acclimated to understanding how to manage their economics.
Yeah, no doubt.
That's my thought.
And so the reason why I interject that question, it seemed a little bit off base, was because how many veterans do we have that are homeless who otherwise might have had your
that's
same
a different
experience?
Conversation, Jeremy.
You know what I'm saying?
That's a different conversation.
But that's what I'm saying.
The country should take care of every homeless veteran.
Absolutely.
That's my thought.
Yeah.
The country, the United States of America,
right.
Should take care of every home. There should not be one veteran,
exactly.
One person that wore the uniform that should not have a place to lay their head.
Exactly. Absolutely.
I'm adamant about that.
Absolutely.
That's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, but and that's why I asked
me,
that question was to get that ignited because it's like we live in a world of complacency. Well, Americans live in a world of complacency where we don't have to do very much to research to look for danger because there is not much danger. So when we take a look at just statistics and analyses and all of these things, we don't realize that the quiet corners, the hidden battles are what could bring this country down. And so when we see, you know, 70% of Americans cannot go into the military because of they're obese or that there's some chronic condition.
Sure.
And so then we're left with 30% people who are available to do that, and then only so many people are able to actually or want to do it.
Sure.
But then they go have a similar experience than you. So the help, I'm just putting, this isn't an all-encompassing statement, but you have, of those 30%, let's just guess that 5% go into the military. They have the same experience as you. They come out of war. Then they're also then, you know, in a situation where they're not able to live a life worth living in the beginning, and because they're going to have struggles when they get out.
Well, you know what I will say, Jeremy, is the resources now are much more prevalent than they were back in the
80s. Absolutely. Yeah.
There are a lot of resources now. You know, the military person, the veteran, just needs to now, listen, you can debate the quality of the resources, but what I will tell you is that there are a lot of resources out there now that weren't back in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's fair.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to demote that, but particularly like in the work that I've done, there's been some tricky things that I've seen happening. Like, you know, I went into a drunk tank because I was assigned as his case manager, and he was a veteran, and he had had a breakdown, and so they put a hold on him, and you know, he's sitting there, and he's about ready to lose his entire livelihood.
Sure.
And his job and all these things. And he said, Jeremy, all I need to do is get out of here and go to work. I just need to make sure I get back to work, because if I don't get back to work, everything falls apart.
That's right.
And so for me, even though I don't have direct military experience, I see from my perspective and what's been shown to me, I know that we're not doing good enough. Oh, and so when we're not, you know, especially
I'm glad you calibrated that, because we're not doing good enough. My statement was there are more resources now than there were back in the mid 80s when I got up, but it's not good enough.
Right. And then I also think Americans need to pay attention to, and this is just more of a political statement, but we need to be paying attention. And this is a touchy subject, and I know I've had conversations with people in the military, and it can get a little bit uncomfortable at times, but making sure that when we go to war, it is for the good of the country and not good of a corporation, that this is not a corporation lobby driven, you know, because like, just for example, I'm not making any overt statements, but what I do know is that Monsanto and Cargill now own land in Ukraine. I do know for a fact that Ukraine is considered the wheat basket of the world, and now Cargill and Monsanto own some of that land. I do know that we're pulling minerals out of, you know, Ukraine. And those kinds of things. So why are we participating in that war? Is it an altruistic reason for the betterment of our country, national security, or is it to extract resources? Because what I think sometimes is I wonder, this is a true wonder, is that if I go into the military and I'm fighting for the good of my country, then at least I know that it was for the good of my country and not as some handler for a corporation and extracting resources. Now, I don't know enough about geopolitical strategies and everything that goes into it or intelligence, but for me, I would think that, okay, if I went and I did things for my country that I later regret, at least I know that there was a reason for the entire country. And maybe it is, I don't know. But when we're talking about veterans getting out, and there has to be a healing. There has to be, can't just be, you know, and I'm adding to what you're saying, not disagreeing with you. I'm saying, yes, they need a place to lay their head, but they also need a place to lay their spirit. They need a place to be able to say, okay, I made mistakes, or I regret this, or I'm having flashbacks, or I'm having, you know, some type of stress response to this deal. How do I regroup? How do I get past that? Because because we can. You did.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Let me just add to that a little bit before you answer. So I look at folks who serve in the military, whether they're there for 3 years or they retire 20 or 30 years. The experience is tantamount to athletes.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Because it's discipline, it's regimented. You do it because you love it. No one forced you to be a football player and take all those injuries.
That's right.
And there are a lot of advantages for those who join the military.
You better believe it. That's right.
Healthcare. You can have a whole family. You get stipends for your rent, live on the base.
That's right.
And all those geopolitical stuff is something that I think, unfortunately, we're going to always have to live with. And to Jeremy's point is, what needs to be done, though, you know, as civilians, former veterans, and people who are out in the business community, to pick up the slack that the VA is unable to really do. They're doing a good job.
Yeah, yeah.
But in your opinion.
I can answer that question. You need to hire veterans.
Huh, ain't that the truth? Seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. These corporations need, and this is not about, you know, some kind of carve out. You know, those of us that have served, we come to the table with a value system, a level of discipline. There's so many intangibles and tangibles. We're trainable, we're coachable. So what I would say is, you know, when a veteran leaves the United States military, then these large corporations should find ways to hire veterans and train them
right
in the discipline that they need in order to help them improve their top line. Because when you come out, you do come out with some skills. Now, those skills may not be readily applicable to what that corporation has, but the veteran can learn.
But what you're talking about are the secondary and tertiary skill sets that you learn in the military and being dynamic and adaptive to a particular environment is exactly what a business needs.
Absolutely.
Because you can teach primary skills all day long. You could how to write a this or how to, you know, wrench that or how to weld this or how to bank that or count this.
Yes.
But you want somebody that's driven, that's going to show up, that understands, you know, orders of operation, mm-hmm. and understands chain of command, that exactly. understands how to report, understands how to be clear and concise
skills.
In communications.
All of those skills,
yeah. you know, combined. And I think that that is one of the most underdeveloped resources we have as a country is by, you know, taking people out of the military or accepting people right out of the military. And I mean, if it were me, if I were president so-and-so, I would say, the military needs a job placement program, like on the spot, that before you leave, you have a job when you get out.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And we're talking like close to six figures.
Right. Because as is the case with student athletes at most of these universities, they have an opportunity to put together a portfolio that allows them to get hired at a particular company or
sure.
agency
absolutely.
Based upon their skill set.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How much of the regimental programs in Marine Corps continue to shape you, and how are you helping shape other people's lives using that basic philosophy?
Yeah. So
Marine Corps philosophy.
Yeah. So results oriented. You know, I always talk about, it's really not about the activity, but what is the result? What is the outcome that you're going to produce? You know, can you execute? Can you execute? One of my favorite books, other than the Bible is my favorite book, but the book is called Execution, The Discipline of Getting Things Done. It's by Ram Charan and Larry Bossidy. And what I find is that, you know, and this is one of the things that I try to teach my mentees or, you know, have conversations with my mentees about. It's really about execution.
Yeah.
You know, you can sit and talk all day long. Like, you can have ideas all day long.
Yeah.
You know, I used to work with this lady, man. I used to call her the PowerPoint queen. She created the most beautiful PowerPoints and everything looks good, but couldn't execute her way out of a paper bag.
Yeah.
Like, nothing got done. Like, I would come back the next week and I said, well, you know, we did that PowerPoint last week and it was all this stuff that was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Where are we?
Yeah.
We want to do another PowerPoint.
That was her way of executing something,
yeah,
right?
Nothing was happening. It looked good in the boardroom.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's about, I'm going to start with, I think any idea, I call it a pop. First of all, what is the purpose? Like, why are you doing this? Second is, what is the outcome that you expect to achieve? Put the outcome first. Be crystal clear on what success looks like. What does it look like? And then quantify it numerically.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be squishy with it. Mm. I'm going to improve this by 50%. And 50%, if I improve it by 50%, here's the number.
Right.
Quantify it numerically. And then after you define the outcome, the last P is the process.
Right.
And then you put the process in place to get to the outcome. And the first two steps that you need to take need to be the largest levers that will get you the closest to the outcome. Because then I look at somebody and they're working in the process. Well, you're doing this little step down here, this little step is not going to get you closer to that result. What's the most impactful thing that you can do that can get you the closest to that outcome?
What you did is you reverse engineered. Most people think that they need to concentrate on the process the outcomes and the purpose. But what you need to do is understand what, and this is for kids growing up that want to be entrepreneurs, kids that, you know, because they think, well, how am I going to get my business started? No, what is your purpose? What purpose do you want to address? What's missing in the world that you want to create a purpose for? And then how do you want to improve it? And then you can focus on the goals, objectives, you know, and those kinds of things to build that. But people, what you're talking about is something I can relate to at my company, is that people want to focus on the skill set. They want to focus on the specific things. And it's like, no, I need my leaders to understand the general purpose, the why. Why are we doing this?
That's first.
Because that you get the buy-in. You get to say, okay, well, I can get down with the why. I believe that this matches my goals as a human being and the company's goals. So now we're aligned. Now we see each other. Then we say, well, how do we want to improve our purpose, or how do we want to make our purpose, you know, quantifiable in such a way that we could say, okay, we're meeting our purpose. Mm-hmm. Then we can start saying, okay, well, what is it going to take to get there?
For me, the outcome is really synonymous with the objectives.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Like
right.
What's, and you have to be very specific.
Measurable, achievable.
Part of being that specific is to quantify it numerically.
Yeah.
And then you go to the process. And the first two or three things you do should be the larger levers that will create the largest impact to get you to that outcome. And so philosophically, that's what I talk about. That's the way I approach business. And that's what I share with my mentees. You know, if they come to me and they say, you know, Mr. Goins or Tony, I want you to mentor me. And, you know, first thing I say is, well, what do you want to do? Well, I don't know. Well, you got to go figure that out first. Because at this point in my life, my time is more valuable than even money.
Yeah.
And I'm not being mean to them, but what I don't have time to do is to just sit around and just pontificate on all this stuff, this pie in the sky stuff.
Right.
You got to go somewhere, get you a hotel room, lock yourself in a room, get a balcony, enjoy a cigar, and figure out what you want to do. Like, really pray about it and figure it out. Like, understand. You know, as a kid, I was blessed to be able to see other business people in front of me. Walter and Yvonne Johnson. I saw Walter Johnson in front of me. This guy was a lawyer. You know, a quick story. So when my grandfather passed away, he left my mother some money. And you know, for black folks, the most challenging part of being able to purchase a home is to save for the down payment. Because when you don't make enough money, you can't. It's just hard to save for a down payment.
Right.
And the money from my grandfather's death, my mother used that along with my father at the time to purchase a home in a middle class black neighborhood. Kings Forest. That was a pivotal moment for me, because now I go from living in an apartment, what we call the projects, okay? Now I'm in a middle class black neighborhood, and across the street I see this man who comes out of his home every morning in a suit and tie. And I'm amazed by that, because the only time I'd ever seen a black man in a suit and tie was on Sundays when they go to church. But why is this man wearing a suit and tie every day? So one morning, I was determined to catch him coming out of his home. And I caught him. I ran outside and I said, his name was Walter Johnson. I said, Mr. Johnson. I said, what do you do? And he called me son, because he was like a father figure to me. He was a father to me. He said, well, son, he said, I'm a lawyer. I have my own law firm. Right now, I'm the parole commissioner for the state of North Carolina. And I also have my own business. I have a chemical company. It was called Barjo. Barbie Johnson, Barjo Chemical Company. And I said, wow, you get to wear a suit and tie every day. He had a briefcase, too. And he said, yeah. And I was looking at him. I was watching him up and down. And what caught my attention were his cuffs. And so I said, what are those things? And so he took his cufflinks out. Now, here's a man getting ready to go to work, but he's taking time with a kid, an 8-year-old kid. And he let me hold those cufflinks in my hand. And I looked at that shirt. I said, Mr. Johnson, when I grow up, I'm gonna get a shirt just like that, and I'm gonna wear cufflinks just like that. I wear cufflinks all the time. If you know, so if you can, you in your mind, you can be what you can see. If I had not seen Walter Johnson in a suit and tie every day, so then at that point in time, I knew I wanted to be a business person. Like, I didn't know what kind of business I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to wear a suit and tie every day. I wanted to be a business person. And so I share that story to say, I force the young folks that are around me to define what you want to do first. Because once you understand what you want to do, then I've got resources and connections and relationships to help you get there.
Absolutely.
But you got to be clear about what you want to do. You got to figure that out.
So how does passion for something play into all this?
Well, actually, let's go ahead and take a break.
Okay.
Because I think that that last quote that he said was a good PowerPoint to, or powerful to
you
end on.
Do a PowerPoint?
Yeah, not PowerPoint. I know. Here we go. PowerPoint, Jeremy. Here we go.
Rain them PowerPoints. Tick me off, but I can't do no PowerPoint.
I never was.
No, I know. It's
PowerPoint. Like, no, yeah. Man, them PowerPoints.
So much for PowerPoints, right?
Yeah.
Mental illness doesn't only affect the person diagnosed by it, affects everyone. If you have a loved one that has been diagnosed with a mental illness and are facing challenges, NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, provides monthly confidential family support groups. You can gain support from peers who understand your experience as well as insight into challenges and successes of others, because it can be overwhelming. For more information, go to www.hiddenbattlesdmi.com or call 402-200-0656. You don't have to do it alone.
That concludes Hidden Battles Destigmatizing Mental Illness podcast. Join in every week. Be sure to subscribe, like, and share. Join in next week
with Tony Goins, and we're going to talk about business. All right.
Be sure to subscribe, like, and share.